All right, guys, continuing the line of unbelievable guests that I somehow convinced to come on my show, today I've got another great one for you. Professor Salim Mansour, who's an associate professor of political science at Western University, used to be called University of Western Ontario, but they've now gone through some sort of branding exercise. Maybe you'll tell us about this. Professor Mansour has written several books, two of which that I'd like to mention today, and we'll probably talk about them. One is Delectable Lie, A Liberal Repudiation of Multiculturalism, which came out in 2011, and then earlier in 2009, Islam's Predicament, Perspectives of a Dissident Muslim. Hey, how you doing, Salim? Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, sir. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Likewise. Thank you. So I thought maybe we could either start by talking about either of those books, but I'm particularly interested, I mean, although both are great, that your treatise of multiculturalism and some of the dangers that it poses in terms of assimilating folks that come into our shores is a really on-point discussion. Maybe you could give us the big synopsis of that argument.
Well, I don't have a copy of it. By the way, there's a second edition out. It came out last year, end of last year in the fall, because the book, though it did not receive as much attention in the Canadian media, it won the Eric Hoffer Book Award in the United States. It won the Montaigne Medal for the most provocative book of the year that it came out. So that was something.
Congratulations.
And the Americans have taken notice of it. I just chuckled to myself, if I had the address for Donald Trump, I would send him a copy.
You don't want to deal with such hateful, racist, KKK, Nazi mongers, or at least that's what he's called.
Well, that's right. I don't know whether there's horn coming out of my head, you know.
Well, we'll get into all that. We'll get into all that. So tell us about multiculturalism, and maybe you could differentiate it from how the typical person understands multiculturalism to be pluralism, right? So if you say, hey, my university is multicultural, you basically mean that there are people of many cultures there. That's not what we mean when we talk about multiculturalism as a political philosophy. So why don't you take it away from there?
That's right. I mean, multiculturalism used as a term, as a word, you know, hyphenated word, thrown around in conversation, it's just okay. I mean, people do understand. I mean, and it can be understood in various ways that we are living in a pluralist world, diverse culture, multi-languages, ethnicity, and all of that. But multiculturalism as a public policy that originated some 40-plus years ago in the term when Prime Minister Trudeau was in office, when he was the Prime Minister, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, that has a totally different connotation, and it has evolved in a totally different way because it has been a term heavily invested by both at the public policy level and by academic political philosophers, anthropologists, sociologists, who have run with that term. You know, in Canada, it became a term to define Canada's identity. So what is now Canada's identity, in a sense, over the last 40 years, it has evolved. We reflect upon it very proudly, by the way, I might say, that the Canadian generally, but particularly the people in politicians, and we once again have the Liberal Party back in power. So this is their term, in the sense that Justin Trudeau's father ran with it, innovated it, and so on. Has a very specific meaning, and it means, and this has now been institutionalized in our statute. There is the Multiculturalism Act, and it has also been referred to in our Charter of Rights and Freedom. I think it's Section 25, 26, and I'm talking out of the top of my head, but there's a clear reference to multiculturalism. And that means as follows, in a very simple sense, God, that all cultures are to be taken as equal and of equal merit and deserving of equal respect. And there cannot be any distinction made. And in making any distinction is then getting onto the slippery slope of ultimately bigotry,
right,
and racism. So A country such as Canada, as it is defining itself and now institutionalized it, is a country that is a multicultural country. There was a time, from Johnny McDonald down to John Diefenbaker, that Canada founding culture was Anglo-French.
Right.
There's a famous statement made in the 1840s, I think, I forget the name right now, by the British Governor General, I think it was, or one of the officer, British official, that Canada has two warring tribes at its bosom, the English and the French, or were to that extent. So that was the sense of who we were. And then other mix of people came along, but that was the founding definition of Canada's as an Anglo-French culture. And there has been the linguistic debate that has taken place, and you and I, and I think your audience are all familiar with, at least the Canadian audience. But then comes in the 1960s, late 60s, during the Pearson era, with the debate over bilingualism and biculturalism, and then gone over, spills over with the Trudeau era of defining Canada. And there were a lot of pressure from others, particularly in Western Canada, in the Prairie provinces, people of European origin, East European origin, who wanted to be recognized for their own special culture or their own special background within this Canadian family. And that, I think, was the push that ultimately led to, there were various commissions, various discussions, led to the idea being settled that we are a multicultural country. And this is, again, if we think about it, the time period, we're going back to the 60s, and Canada had not yet, nor had America, gone into the open immigration policy. That came in the mid-1960s in the United States in 1965 with the passage of the Act on Immigration that opened up immigration from non-European societies. And similarly in Canada, that came in the late 60s and early 70s, especially in the Trudeau era. So that's the background. And the idea has become, in a sense, established that we are a multicultural society and all cultures are equal.
Now, let me interject here. One of the ways by which you're able to argue, not you, but the people who are proponents of multiculturalism, to argue for this particular philosophy is the idea of cultural relativism, right? And moral relativism, right? So, I mean, who am I to judge the cultural, religious, moral practices of another? They've got their own idiosyncratic cultural and history, and who am I to impose my hegemony upon them? And this is exactly what then shackles people like Justin Trudeau. At the time, he was only a member of parliament before he became prime minister, to not be able to accept that certain practices coming from folks like honor killing and female genital mutilation and child bride, when somebody had mentioned that these practices were barbaric, his instinctual response was, you know, he doesn't accept that you would call such practices barbaric. So what he focused on is the fact that you were, in a sense, insulting the practices of another culture, rather than actually having the correct moral compass to say, no, in Canada, those values we don't accept. And so I think that's one of the dangers, right? And I guess you'll talk about this, that the downstream effect of this notion of multiculturalism is that it shackles people from being able to speak openly about practices that, frankly, are inconsistent with secular liberal values, correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. But all of that would come eventually.
Okay.
At the genesis of the argument, which is in the 1970s, early 1970s, the issue was that the political leaders, in this case the Liberal Party, supported by, actually there was no opposition to it from, at that time, the Progressive Conservative Party or the New Democratic Party, to the idea. In fact, everyone embraced the idea at that time in the early 1970s, the notion that Canada is a multicultural country. But all of the effects would come later on that you are describing. It is interesting to note that the proposition of multiculturalism as a concept and therefore an identity for Canada is itself a construction, is an invention. It was as if, you know, Canada was proposing some sort of a new idea in terms of political philosophy or cultural, you know, anthropology, that we as a country and as a nation is multicultural. You look around the world, nobody else had thought about this. You know, it is as if, you know, we were inventing a weed. Okay. If you really think about, if there are other, if this concept had any substantive internal consistency and value, then obviously others would have also thought about it. I mean, I come from a part of the world as someone born in India and therefore of Indian origin. I don't think, and I say this simply as an anthropological or sociological fact, no judgment is involved in this, that possibly there's no country in the world, country that means with a border and a center and a government, a state, sovereignty. There's no country in the world more multicultural than India.
Right.
1.2 billion people.
How many languages spoken?
More than 30 exactly. Recognized languages. Right. And then there are innumerable dialects, multiplicity of ethnicity.
Religions.
All the religions of the world right. Represented in India at one time and the other. I grew up with Jewish families in yes. Calcutta,
right?
Who then left in the 1960s when I was, you know, growing up and entering my teenage years.
You're a practicing Muslim, by the way, for people.
I'm a practicing Muslim.
Exactly.
India is the second largest Muslim country in the world, which few people understand and yeah. recognize. You know,
about 150 million. Is that right?
It's around about 175, 180 million. Okay. So it is in the same figures, you know, and these census figures will change, you know, at the next census when it takes place. But India is about the same as Pakistan, more or less, or maybe India is a little more than Pakistan. The largest Muslim country is Indonesia with 230 million Muslim. So India is the second largest or the third largest or second and third combined in the world. And so it is the most multicultural country. But if you tell an Indian that you are a multicultural country, they will look at you and figure out, what are you talking about? You know, we are Indian. I mean, if you go right. to India, you know, right. They would say we are Indian. You know, we happen to be a Punjabi or, you know, from Bengal. I'm from Bengal, from Calcutta, or a Sikh or any number of ethnicity and group. But those are sub-identity. Right. The primary identity is we are Indian. And it is not a hyphenated identity, you know.
Right.
And by the way, English is still the official language of right. India.
Right.
The only way India can work is through English.
So in your vision, by the way, so I am Canadian, you're Canadian, then we are Lebanese, Jew, Indian, Muslim, right? What supersedes anything else in our identity, and actually I would say more than Canadian, is our support for defending secular liberal values. I mean, at least if I speak for myself, and I'm sure you probably agree, that that's probably the thing, if I were to say what defines me, before being Jewish, before being Lebanese, before being Canadian, I am a defender of free societies. And then everything else can flow from there.
Well, it is interesting, God, that you and I, you, a Jew of Lebanese background, me, a Muslim of Indian background, I don't think either of us can claim to be Caucasian.
No. That's why, by the way, we're a nightmare for the apologists, right? Because we score very high on what is known as oppression Olympics or victimology poker. We're untouchable, and I don't mean it in the Indian caste system. I mean it in that you can't attack us precisely for the reasons that you mentioned.
No, exactly. And so both of us are quite simply, without any ambiguity, want to be Canadian. We say, who are you? I have talked about this in my writings, in my public affair programming, and so on and so forth. By the way, I don't know if you know that I was a candidate for the Conservative Party.
Do you want to talk about it now, or do you want to leave it for...
No, I just want to refer it, because this issue emerged during my campaign.
Sorry to interrupt you. If you ran, of course, for the Conservative Party, that must only mean that you are a Nazi, xenophobe, KKK member, right? Because we know that the Liberals are all about liberal values, and anybody who in any way supports anything about the Conservative Party must have been part of the Nazi Party, right?
Well, if that's the way my opponents want to define me, that's fine. You know, I mean, you know, we get branded by the outside. You know, if there is anything liberal, it is to listen to what we as individuals have to say about ourselves.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, the book that you mentioned, Delectable Lie, the subtitle of it, God, is a liberal repudiation of multiculturalism.
Exactly.
And it is with a small L, liberal.
Right.
So I discuss that in the book. You know, I mean, if where I come from, in my own development and life lived and experience and world travel, that if I have to identify myself in terms of political philosophy, I'm a classical liberal.
Exactly.
My guru, if I use the Indian term, my guru, I never met him, but it is I simply revered him, and basically my thinking was shaped by reading him and following him, was Sir Isaiah Berlin. I'm sure you know the name.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so I in that sense, you know, and a classical liberal is the one who emphasizes on freedom. But freedom means nothing if it is not individual freedom.
Exactly right.
You know, so we don't need to, when people talk about group identity, group freedom, that's only one small step leading up to individual freedom.
Right.
And if there is no individual freedom, then the group identity itself then becomes an oppressive tool to crush the individual.
And I was going to say that the Liberal Party, in the context of Canadian politics, is the one that is a more staunch supporter of the notion of identity politics, right? So if you were truly a classical liberal in the way that you're defining it, where the individual is at the center of everything rather than identity of groups, then you would expect the Liberal Party to repudiate, as you correctly said, these ideas of identity politics. Yet they are the ones who typically are the ones who push this idea forward. Why is that? How did it evolve that the Liberal Party is the one that is more in touch with this, you know, movement of identity politics? Why is that?
Well, I mean, we're turning now, I mean, if we spend a little time on this, we're turning towards a discussion of political philosophy. And classical liberalism, though it emphasizes in its origin, in its genesis, if we go back in time, is about freedom in the sense of individual freedom, you know. But alongside it is also the demand for equality, for equal treatment.
Right.
So there is that tension within political philosophy of classical liberalism between liberty and equality, between freedom and equality. I mean, the great slogan of the French Revolution, which is again part of that classical revolutionary movement, is
Fraternité, égalité.
Yeah. Egalité, fraternité, yeah. You know. So that tension is always there. And that is the creative tension. It is a necessary tension. It is a positive tension. The problem comes when that tension snaps by some public policy decision or the individuals or the group choose to snap that tension and put the weight on one side or the other side.
Right.
You know, no man is an island unto himself. Remember the classic line of John Donne. You know, I mean, a society is a network of relationships. But it's a network of relationships bound together on an agreement and a consensus, as John Locke would say, the social contract.
Right.
We as individuals come together to form a society.
Right.
I tell my students all the time, there is very little difference between rape and love.
Oh, boy. Direct your anger mail to Professor Mansour.
Let me just fill it out. You see, the way it sounds, but rape and love in the sense of the physical act, but one is coercion.
Right.
One is the mangling of the individual right, and the other is the fusion of the two people coming together.
Wow, that is some solid Indian poetry right there.
No, but you imagine. No,
I get it. Yes, sure.
We get confused about these things, and talking to the young people and making them come together to understand. You know, that's what it is all about. So life cannot be completely separated. So there is a tension.
Right.
What has happened in our time, in the modern world, the post-1945 world, as it has evolved, it comes to 1970, and as it evolved, the Liberal Party turned from small L liberal to becoming a big L liberal,
right,
which became an emphasis on the state and the use of the instrument of the state to direct the people,
right,
to direct individuals, you know. And there, by the necessity of what the Liberal Party went in that direction as a big L liberal, the emphasis becomes on equality.
You're
and so
accepted.
Creating equality is, the you know, the equality not as an opportunity where you create a level playing field and let the individuals compete, but you want the outcome of equality to be predetermined.
Right, right. Well, I actually, I just did a clip on the, I don't know if you heard about the Oscar So White hashtag, which is basically the idea that, you know, how dare there not be a proper racial demographic representation in the people who are nominated. And I thought that that was absolute lunacy, and I satirized that. But I wanted to get next to, I'm not sure if this is where I had originally heard of you. Go ahead.
But if I might just finish, because you began with
something,
and the book that I wrote about it, I mean, all of this was coming up. In the 1970s and 80s, multiculturalism idea was taken as a Canadian identity guard, because I think there's part of, in the Canadian national identity, that is the Anglo-French, I think there is a streak of some sort of lack of confidence, some sort of a, I don't want to put it inferiority complex, but there is a tinge of that, because we are a 30 million people or 34 million people today. 30 years ago, we were much smaller. We were about 15, 20 million people when all of this discussion began, even less. And we are sitting on the largest, outside of former Soviet Union, now Russia, territory, the largest piece of real estate, on top of the greatest power ever in history, that is the United States, with the longest undefended border. And we trying to figure out, you know, we have to be different from the Americans, even though, you know, the differences are nominal, but we have to. I mean, I think this is the inferiority complex that comes in of those, and maybe it is the Liberal problem and the NDP problem, and has become a progressive conservative or not conservative problem, that we have to shore up our differences with the United States somehow. And it's not a problem with the Mexicans.
By the way, that dynamic is further exacerbated in the context of Quebec, where you now have a whole set of additional dynamics, right? Because in Quebec, you not only have the issues that you're talking about, which is how do we differentiate ourselves from our bigger cousin to the south of us, but you then also have the French issue, where people are very, very concerned about being swallowed by a tsunami of English. And so in Quebec, we then set up, when I say we, I mean the governments, typically set up laws that in any other context would be considered Orwellian and contrary to freedom. But they do so under the guise of that's the only way that we can protect our unique culture. But I'd really like to move on to some other stuff, if I may. Is that okay?
Yeah, but
let's wrap it up so that we, because I got so many things I want to talk to you about. So we gotta move quickly.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I was saying earlier that you and I met originally in Montreal a few years ago, and I'm not sure if that coincided roughly with when you gave. And I'm going to ask all the viewers who haven't watched it to go and see your testimony in front of the House of Commons. I think it was in October 2012, where you appeared in front of this committee on immigration. And here you are, a practicing Muslim. You're speaking in front of these folks, and you're saying, hey guys, let's halt immigration from Muslim countries. And of course, you know, your words were absolutely the right tenor, the right, there's no hate, there's no anger, there's no animosity towards any individuals. You're speaking from a very liberal position. And of course, Donald Trump said a lot less than anything that you said, and yet he was, of course, accused of being the biggest hate monger and Nazi. So I thought maybe you could start by telling us about your testimony and what has been the response, both from the general public and, if any, from politicians to that very powerful testimony. Take it away.
Well, Gad, I don't have it in front of me, so I'll have to be. I'm digging into my memory now, as you correctly point out. That was a few years ago, 2012, I think it was October 2012, and I was invited by the Parliamentary Committee on Citizenship and Immigration to speak on a number of issues, and I took the opportunity to make my presentation. And what at the heart of it, I pointed out was the need to consider a moratorium. I use the word moratorium on immigration from Muslim countries, specifically from the areas where it is the most affected by jihadi terrorism, and which is in fact the cradle of jihadi terrorism, and from where it has been exported. And of course, nobody wanted to talk around the committee table.
They all put their head down. They didn't want to make eye contact with you.
People wanted to duck and run away from that discussion. They fell back to, and it was amusing that the conservative members of the committee fell back to talking about multiculturalism in terms of how wonderful we are. We respect the name Muhammad, and so on and so forth, and. And the others, of course, totally avoided it. You know, they didn't want to get into the technicalities of it. Well, I was putting it in the context of the debate that has been going on in terms of, again, back to identity. If we are going to be a multicultural society and we are going to have an unending immigration, then we're going to lose the sense of who we are, because we are stripping away the identity and saying all the cultures are equal. That is what led me to writing the book. What is the standard by which we judge equality? Do we say that a culture that lands a man on the moon and a culture that worships stone are equal?
Right.
You know? And all the variation in between. And so for me, as a classical liberal, and we are here in Canada, in North America, in the West, what should be our standard be? We have gone beyond the issue of arguing about people in terms of identity politics, which is the physical attributes.
Right.
You know, we should be, at least, we've gone beyond that. All of these things should have been washed away. So what is it that identify us in the West? And it just comes back to the question of liberty, freedom, what you talk about in terms of secularism,
right.
Liberal democracy, a society that values individual for what the individual is. That's our culture. And then on that, we are bending backward to accommodate and say it's all fine to those cultures which are being imported into Canada through immigration, that repudiates these arguments.
Exactly right.
In practice or in terms of their own religion, culture, philosophy, and whose emphasis is on group identity. You know, and all the layers of the problem, whether it is gender problem, whether it's sexual orientation problem, whether it's respect for minorities, religion, on
Jews.
And on.
So, pardon? Respect for Jews.
Respect for Jews, that's what I said,
minorities, exactly right.
Yeah, you know, and on. And so it is in the world of 9/11 and post 9/11, it is only in the real world these issues have emerged. In the abstract discussion of the 1970s, when Canada was pretty white, when I came to Canada about 40 plus years ago, I remember, you know, we're going to university in the mid 1970s. Toronto was pretty much a white city.
Right.
You know, I remember David Crombie, who was called the little perfect mayor of Toronto. You know, he was a small man, a short man. And walking, I lived downtown Toronto. I lived close to the university. I lived on, if you know Toronto, and some of your audience might know about it, Church Street and Wellesley area. Now, that is the heart of the Grey Pride Toronto.
Right.
But when I was there, you know, it was just another small neighborhood, and it was pretty much a white neighborhood. That's a European Caucasian. Well, Toronto now has a population, more than half of Toronto's population are not born in Canada. I was not born in Canada, but you know, that's what it is. The immigrant population, the hyphenated Canadian population, now is larger in Toronto and the GTA than those who would be simply identified themselves as Canadian.
Right.
You see, so it has profoundly changed. So in the 1970s, when these discussions took place, it took place in the context of Canada, the United States, and the Anglo-French issue. You know, and nobody had a sense, and nobody could imagine the world in 1970s where the world was heading. But we are now in the post 9/11 world, and the whole dogmatic creation of the argument of multiculturalism crashes, because you have to ask the question, how can a culture that values individual freedom and rights, which is the Charter of Rights and Freedom, it is the same as a culture that says group identity? And coming back to Islam, say for instance, the Sharia law, which says men and women are not equal.
Right. Punishments are meted as a function of the identity of the perpetrator and the victim. So right there, it is perfectly inconsistent with any Western canon of law, certainly Canadian law or the American Constitution, yet people don't realize that.
Absolutely. And then, you know, in about a dozen years ago, in the early 2000s, that is soon after 9/11, right here in Ontario, there was a huge push by the NDP for bringing in Sharia law. It was the activity of immigrant Muslims like myself, and particularly Muslim women.
Right.
One of the most notable women was this lady whom I know, Homa Arjuman. She's a Persian background. And her leadership to bring us together to oppose Sharia law, because Sharia law is itself profoundly discriminatory.
Right.
And has no place in a society that values liberal democracy.
Now here's, this is a wonderful sort of stepping stone to my next question, right? You've got guys like you, Rahil Raza, who'll be on my show soon, Tariq Fatah, who I'm hoping to also bring on the show, this lady that you mentioned, and a whole bunch of other Muslims, many of them practicing, some are not, secular, committed to freedoms, committing to all the liberal values that we all love. And then, of course, you've got other Muslims who bring their cultural and religious baggages that are not consistent with our values. And then the very pragmatic problem becomes, so what do you do, right? I mean, how do you create an immigration system where you find a way to let in the ones who are going to flourish and thrive within our liberal democracies and keep the ones who are going to be problematic out, right? So somewhere between letting no one in and letting everyone in lies the right answer. But how do we find that point is, I guess, one of the great questions of our time. Do you have any sense of how we should go about
this? I gave that answer, and that's when in my book, and also in the hearing that you referred to, as you pulled between having a complete open door and closing the door, there's a whole spectrum, a bandwidth in which we have to find, or we should be searching for, the right fit that preserves our liberal democracy while it meets our demographic requirement. I mean, one of the problems of the Western world is the demographic problem. I mean, and that's another subject. But it seemed that in history, in modern, in 10,000 years of history, if any society has willfully taken on measures to commit a harakiri, it is the most advanced Western democracy that has done it, you know?
And that is really true. I mean, I've used similar terms, right? I mean, you really do get the sense that there's this kind of collective death wish amongst some of our political intelligentsia, where it doesn't matter how much evidence they are exposed to. I call them the ostrich brigade, right? The head is in the sand, and I will simply not accept any evidence that is contrary to my utopic unicornia worldview. I mean, Angela Merkel, from one side of her mouth, will say that multiculturalism has been an abject failure. From the other side of her mouth, she says, we've got to increase the people that we let in. 1 million this past year is not enough. We've got to accelerate it. So what's happening in her head? Is she suffering from a schism, a schizophrenic break, or what is going on? How could they reconcile these things?
Well, what is happening, Saad? I mean, without demonizing anyone,
Sure.
these are not only public policy issues, but
Sure.
these are also part of political philosophy. Is the issue like I pointed out that at the heart of classical liberalism, and I use the word advisedly, classical liberalism, to distinguish it from the bigger liberalism or libertarianism.
Right.
In classical liberalism, there is that fundamental tension between liberty and equality. You see, and that tension is a creative tension. It is like between our genes as human beings, the X chromosome and the Y chromosome. There's a tension that creates us. So there's that reality of that. And you don't expunge one or the other. You allow, and the question is to find the balance. What's happening in the European mind, and Angela Merkel, and in Canadian mind, and in the West, United States is now getting in the same fix, is that we as a society went in a certain direction because of our tremendous, tremendous advances in science and technology and so on and so forth. To create a society where choices of what we can do to ourselves as human beings individually, it has completely gone beyond what Aldous Huxley had talked about in New Brave World. You know,
Right.
we can re-engineer ourselves. And one of the re-engineering unintended consequences of that has been that we can choose whether we want to reproduce or not reproduce.
Right.
So the little tablet that came along in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the pill,
Right.
that changed. I mean, that little tablet was as consequential as Einstein's equation E equal MC squared.
Right.
The
Well, we
unintended consequences had to build up over time. And so we see now the collapse of the fertility rate.
and I was going to say, sorry to interject, and I mentioned this with another guest recently. Many Muslim theorists and Muslim politicians have, in various forms, argued that the way to conquer the West is never going to be through military might, right? Terrorism is just sort of this diversion, fun tactic, fun in quotes. We're going to conquer the West through hijrah, right? Through immigration. We're going to conquer the West by using your miserable freedoms against you, which is exactly what we're talking about. And then we're going to conquer the West through the womb of our women. And that's exactly speaking to your fertility, right? I mean, if you've got a society that doesn't reproduce enough to maintain itself. The number I think is 2.1 or whatever the number is. And then you've got another group of folks that are producing many more. Now that is construed as a racist argument. There's nothing racist about it. It's just a demographic fact. So the Sharia attempt that you spoke of in the early 2000 didn't pass through because the numbers are not in the favor of those that wish for it to pass through. And so you dodge the bullet. But wait enough time, get the demographic realities to change, and suddenly, by using your miserable freedoms against you, in this case, democracy, then we could pass Sharia law. And so I think that's the type of issue, the nuance, that people don't appreciate, right? They think that as soon as you start engaging in the conversation that we're having, you're xenophobic. And we have to be able to kick this obnoxious reflex away from us, because otherwise we're inching to a slow but certain death.
Oh, absolutely. My concern, I mean, as an individual who happened to be a Muslim, I didn't choose. I was born in a Muslim family. You can push the argument that, well, you have ultimately a choice what faith you want to belong to or what, geography you want to go and live at and so on. Those are choices, yes. Okay, so I choose to be a Muslim. But my sense of being a Muslim has no contradiction in my sense of also being a free individual, a rational free individual.
Tell us about that, because that's actually one of the questions I wanted to touch upon. How do you reconcile your Muslim? Is it that you are a cultural Muslim, but you reject all the faith parts? Or do you pick and choose which parts are consistent with your secular liberal? How do you reconcile those two things? Because for many people, they have a hard time doing it.
Well, again, this is a very large, complex issue, you know, and how one should boil it down to, I myself don't know within a matter of a couple of minutes. But let me throw out the following observation. Bernard Lewis, you know, possibly the greatest living, by the way, he's going to be 100 years.
I know, he's still alive, incredible.
Love that man, love his writing, you know, consider him, you know, my guru also, like Isaiah Berlin in the sense of history and so on and so forth. Bernard Lewis, among other great, great thinkers and writers of Islam, whether Muslims and non-Muslims, have pointed out that the word Islam means many things to many people. You know, we use the word Islam to emphasize or to suggest different things, but within the term Islam, we put it down to as a talking point. We're talking about religion, we're talking about people, but that is insufficient, you know. In Christianity, there has been distinction made, the language evolved. We talk about Christendom, that is the culture of Christianity.
Right.
Like kingdom, Christendom.
Right.
But there's no such parallel, analogous word. I mean, there was a great American scholar of Islam and historian, Marshall Hodgson, who tried to propose the word Islamdom, but it never went.
Well, I mean, the Ummah could be considered that, no? I mean,
Ummah is a people, the land, Dar al-Islam, okay. So within Dar al-Islam, there was... people of all sorts of different ethnicity,
right,
which means different culture. As I again point out to my student, to talk about Christianity and Christian, is it a Palestinian religion? It is, of course, you know, we go back genealogically, you know, Jesus was born to a Jewish mother.
Right.
You know, and one doesn't have to be a Christian to go and look into historically where he is coming from. As a Christian, one takes on a different meaning about Jesus, you know, who Jesus is, and so on and so forth. But the simple matter is that Jesus was born to a Jewish mother in the land which we today call Palestine or Judea, Samaria, Nazareth, grew up in Jerusalem, was crucified there, and so on and so forth. And the religion could have been simply another heresy from born out of Jewish tradition.
Right.
And gone in that direction. But today, and only you could say that to be Christian is that a people of Jewish background who followed Jesus or people born in that area. And so Christianity is very much a Middle Eastern religion. But that would be an absurd thing to say today in 2016. Christianity is over 2 billion people from Philippines to Iceland to Kalahari Desert to the Amazonian forest, you know, with tremendous diversity in culture and language and history, in sense of identity. So what is common between a Filipino Christian and an Amazonian inhabitant? Both praying towards Jesus. There has to be some commonality, but the diversity is also immense. Islam is similar. Islam is a world religion and immensely diverse. Its origin and its roots are in that little area of Arabia, Hijaz, Mecca and Medina, where Muhammad was born, grew up, and within that. But then it grew from there. It expanded. Arabs, and particularly the Arabs of Prophet Muhammad's background, that is from the Arabian Peninsula, is an insignificant minority within the larger framework of the Muslim world.
Now, let me stop you there. Now, of course, what you're saying basically is that every individual, if not every culture that practices a particular religion, will bring their own idiosyncratic realities to interpreting that religion. Nobody contests that. But of course, each of these religions does have a set of codified narratives that define the religion, right? So in Judaism, it is incontestable that you're not supposed to eat pork. Most Jews eat pork not because they are practicing a different version of Judaism. It's because they decide that they're going to ignore that particular tenet, right? So I'm Jewish. I break the Sabbath. That doesn't mean I'm a different type of Jew. It means that I am a Jew who decides to ignore the Sabbath. So when you say that you or others are practicing their very many varied plurality of Islam, that's true because you're all individuals. But Islam itself is Islam. So it contains passages, elements that are problematic to the things that we are talking about. So how do you or how do we in the West find a way to nullify those passages so that hopefully we could have lesser tension between those, that Islam and the West, right?
Yeah, you're right. I was prefacing my remark. I won't get into Judaism because there is both, the way you defined it, but that there's a certain thing about being Jewish that is almost unique. You know, I think the closest parallel to being Jewish without necessarily having to follow maybe the Ten Commandments, for instance, right. You know, would be or living by the code of ethics found in Talmud would be Hinduism. In fact, Hinduism is the oldest living religion today. But you know, in the critical sense of being a Hindu, one cannot become a Hindu. One cannot convert to Hinduism. One is born into Hinduism.
Oh, you cannot convert to Hinduism.
Okay, you're born into Hinduism because you're born into a particular caste.
Right. Got it.
So you can be culturally Hindu, you know. So all the Hare Krishna, Hare Ram people running around, they have adopted the cultural values,
right,
or the philosophical value of the Vedantic traditions and so on and so forth, you know. There are key principles there. I mean, in Hinduism, the key principle deals with the whole meaning of reincarnation,
right,
which is part of it, karma and sanskara, and that would take me in a different direction.
Right.
I'll hold back. But those are your born with it, because that you're born because it's your second birth, you know,
right,
your karmic birth that makes you a Hindu. Somewhat similar is with Judaism. You have no choice. Your mother was a Jew. You were born to a Jewish mother.
And there's nothing, by the way, if I could interject, because I had asked once a rabbi, is there anything that I can do? So if I say, I don't believe in the Jewish religion, I'm very Jewish, but all the religious booga booga stuff, I'm not part of that. Does that make me a non-Jew? He said, no, there is nothing that you can do that doesn't make you a Jew, which then, in a sense, was good news for me, because then I could say, hey, I'm a Jewish atheist, and I'm actually exactly correct.
But you're right, God, but Judaism, and therefore Jews, have gone through the millstone of change, have been crushed and pressured in so many different ways that our has come. Now you are in 2016, or a modern Jew can say thing, live thing, and go through it that makes the Jew stand apart. I mean, remember, only 350 years ago, or thereabouts, my dating might be a little problematic, but Spinoza was excommunicated.
Yes, true.
And if Jews had power, that if there was a Jewish authority, the Grand Sanhedrin,
yep,
you know, run by the great rabbis, you know, and the laws of the Torah was being applied, then Spinoza would have been decapitated or hung.
and I wouldn't have had a very good ending either, I don't
that's
think.
That's right. I point out to my students and others, you know, that the very quick way, I mean, since we are having this conversation, the very quick way to understand the problems of the Muslim world today, or Islam, if you want to put it, in relationship to the two other Abrahamic religion. I mean, whatever others might say, I mean, some of us do insist that this is an Abrahamic family of religion, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is the Jews, that this 2016, it is somewhere in the calendar 5,780, you know, the dating. So, you know, the 6,000 years old, you know, the Jewish history. And if we can quickly do the division on that, so we can say the Jew is a 60-year-old man who has seen the world, who's gone through everything, you know, whose wisdom is in every pore. The wisdom comes from experience. He's lived a life, you know. And there is no testosterone burning, you know. He knows it. He has everything seen it, you know. The Christian is 2016.
Right.
So in relationship, it is 20-year-old.
Right.
Just gone through the teenage year and is now 20 years old, you know. And it might have got the voting right. It's got the car of the fathers, you know, to drive the car. It is getting adult and responsible, you know, and you have to think about how you're going to pay your rent, how you're going to do this, that, and, you know. And so, and there's a certain degree of awareness. I mean, awareness is what leads to humility, to, you know, to understanding the other. So you can see Christians are moving. The world of Christianity is moving in that direction. Then you come to Islam. What is the century of Islam? This is 1430s.
Right.
So Islam, Muslim, is a 14-year-old kid.
Right.
I have a daughter. She's getting from 11 to 12, you know, 14-year-old. Just teenager.
So
the testosterone is bursting. The hormones are bursting. Nothing understands them, you know.
Please direct your hate mail to Professor Mansour for comparing Islam to a hormonal teenager.
It is.
But so what you're basically saying, if I can sort of distill your analogy or your metaphor, what you're basically saying is that in Judaism, this wisdom has led to use the term reformation. The young Christian is going through those growing pains, and then of course the Islamic religion has yet to really go through those pains, which then leads us very naturally actually to the next point I wanted to touch upon. So if we take your very poignant lifeline, does that mean that how you're holding out hope is that Islam will grow into the wise man through a process of reformation? And if that's what you're saying, what is the mechanism by which the doctrines can be reformed? Is it possible? Are there tools within Islam that would allow for a reformation to take place so that those problematic passages can be somehow nullified?
Yeah, we cannot be dogmatic about these issues, God, but we can learn by reflecting on the past. You know, that's what history is so fascinating about, and in comparative sense. So, yes, I mean, when Christianity was a teenager, as opposed to being 20-year-old, if I stick to my metaphor, Christianity in this 14th, 15th century of Christianity was going through the hell of a problem,
right,
that you're saying what Islam is going through in its 14th and 15th century, you know. Warfare, bigotry, massacres of people, you know, looking for witches and burning them at stake, you know.
Inquisitions.
People,
right.
You know. I mean, next year, God, 2017, we will mark, the world will mark the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther pinning the 95 theses in the church in Germany at Wittenberg.
Right.
Okay.
Here I stand. That's the, isn't that?
What's
the,
that?
I think he said, here I stand.
Well, that was when he was being tried.
Right, exactly. Yes, go on.
And so his thesis, but that came almost a century after. I mean, the process had been going on. I mean, one goes back in time. Last year, 2015, was the 600th anniversary of the burning at stake of John Huss,
right,
in Bohemia, who is a predecessor of Martin Luther in terms of the reform movement. You can go back to the 13th century. So, you know, back again, you know, teenager in the Christian, in my metaphor, with Roger Bacon and Erasmus and others writing. And the discussions had begun. The discussions had begun as the Christians of Western Europe started encountering the ancient writings from Greece, Plato and Socrates. But how did they encounter them? They encountered them through the Muslim, the Arabs,
right,
who did the translation and the work and who were talking about it. St. Thomas Aquinas, 13th century, was a student in that sense, like I'm a student of Sir Isaiah Berlin or Bernard Lewis, was a student of the great Averroes. This is the Latinization of Ibn Rushd.
Yes, yes.
Who was a teacher of the second Moses, Moses ben Maimonides.
Yes, love the
guy. They were the two great friends from Cordoba.
Yes.
In Andalus. And Ibn Rushd was the translator. He was of Aristotle, and he was writing about these things. So the discovery of philosophy by the Christian fathers began the discussion that then reached with Martin Luther, the 95 Theses, which then opened up the can of worms of warfare and taking position that led to the next 250, 300 years of warfare in Europe and making a modern Europe.
But let me ask you this.
When you talk about secularism, when you talk about individual freedom or liberty, these concepts did not just drop from the sky.
Of course.
They came as a result of the struggle.
So then you would reject the idea. I mean, I love your optimism because I think that's something that's important for people to hear. But some will say that there are canonical elements or doctrinal elements within Christianity and Judaism that allowed for the light of Reformation to seep its way through the doctrines that is not afforded by Islam. In other words, they will argue that there is something unique in the doctrines of Islam. Let's take one example, and one can debate it, but these words are the final, inerrant, time-invariant for all times and places words, and mefi haraf, that means there isn't a single letter that you're supposed to change. Now, so who's right? Is it the case that what you're saying is correct? That, look, given enough time, given as the 14-year-old child grows up, he will become wise just like the other two people did? Or are the folks who are less optimistic, are they onto something by saying there are unique challenges in Islamic doctrines? Or are both right? What's your take on that?
Well, again, I would put it in this way, both for you and for your people who tune into this conversation that you and I are having. The Abrahamic tradition, Christianity, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, in that sense, form the Abrahamic tradition, the family of religion, is based upon the idea of revelation. What does revelation mean? Revelation means that a higher power, a higher authority, which we call God, Jehovah, Yahweh, or that which cannot be named, YHDA, right?
Allah in Arabic.
Allah, or you know, in English, God, Dio. This higher power reveals himself to us, the human being, you know. Reveals himself and gives certain guidance, which is the moral guidance. Religion is a code of moral and ethical guidance. You know, in Islam, it is talked about Islam is Deen al-Fitra, the natural religion. So God reveals himself. In the Abrahamic tradition, Jews and Muslims, the revelation is the word. God reveals himself through word. God speaks to mankind or to a chosen person, the individual, the prophet,
right,
who then takes the message. So God reveals himself to Moses. God said that you turn your face because you won't be able to see me.
Right.
Well, you know, and he revealed himself when the face of the Mount Sinai was smashed or something of that thing happened. He revealed himself through a burning bush and spoke to Moses. You know, these are all metaphors.
It's funny, though, how he always seems to reveal himself to a single individual while nobody else is around to witness it.
Well, I mean, again, you're going into a different problematic. So, you know, I mean, if you want to talk about, you have identified yourself as Jewish atheist, you know, whatever that means, you know. I think there's a bundle of contradiction there, but still. But the point is, we are now discussing something that is not to get into polemics,
right,
to understand. So in the Abrahamic tradition, the revelation takes place. God reveals himself through words. So there is the Torah,
right,
the five books of Moses. And of course, the heart of it is the Decalogue. That's the revelation. God reveals himself to Muhammad. That's the Quran. The words that Muhammad heard or memorized, and then he spoke out, which was then transcribed in many forms, and which today forms the written word, the Quran. The Christians are the departure from this tradition. So that's where Jews and Muslims are people of the book in that very precise sense
of the word, yeah.
Ahl al-Kitab. The Christian, for them, revelation is God assumes the identity of a man. He becomes a man, right? So where the word of God is divine to Jews and Muslims, the Decalogue is divine, the Quran is divine, to Christianity, Jesus is divine. So God, the revelation is in flesh. To Jews and Muslim, revelation is in word. Okay, so there is the revelation. But once God has revealed himself, God retreats. And then what happens? Then it is the people
that interpret,
who have to make sense of that revelation. Right. And what then happens is theology, no longer revelation.
Right.
Paul, the Jew.
So, before you go on, so in the Islamic tradition, that's when you talk about tafsir, right?
No, we talk, tafsir is interpretation.
Right. So you're interpreting, you take the original revelations, and then you interpret it. And this is, it's through that mechanism.
We will not get into too dense a discussion.
Sure.
Lose the track. But one of the affinity between Jews and Muslims is that neither Jews nor Muslims develop too much of theology. The word for the Muslims in theology is kalam. So they did not develop. Why? Because the Jews and the Muslim mind, if you're talking about the mind now, Jewish mind, Muslim mind, Raphael Patai wrote two great books, The Jewish Mind and The Muslim Mind. You know, the Jewish mind and Muslim mind were not tortured with the issue about the unity of God or the oneness of God, Ahad. There was no problem with that, you know. God is God. He's revealed himself. This is it. Man and God is not the same. There is a complete separation. Man is the creation of God. God is unique and separate. So the Jews and Muslims have devoted their time and their energy to law.
Right.
That is the interpretation, tafsir, the interpretation of the law. The whole Talmudic tradition is spinning on the needle's head. How many angels dance spinning on the needle's head? Oh, what is kosher? What is not kosher? How you live your life and so on and so forth within the parameters of God's revelation.
Right.
And same thing is with Muslim. The whole debate has been about law. That is the Sharia code. Sharia is not about defining God or understanding God. It is the problem of the Christian in Christianity. How do you explain a man is God? How do you explain Trinity and unity?
Right.
And so this whole, and in fact, the major fight within Christianity is about defining God. You know, whereas in Islam and Judaism, it has been about living the life.
But so if I could just bring it back to sort of a pragmatic, practical thing. So let's say we take Sharia law, right? We both agree that there are endless elements of Sharia law that are problematic, that are inconsistent with secular liberal values. So how would the shape of a reformation take place where you defang Sharia law from the discussion of Islam? In other words, what would be the mechanism? What would be the tools by which you'd be able to say, you know what, most of the stuff that's in Sharia law, we're no longer going to accept it as part of a discussion of Islam. It's out. It's a non-starter. What are the tools, the pragmatic, right? So, I mean, the theological issues are very interesting, but in the real world, we don't care as much about them. How do we nullify those elements that are inconsistent with our, say, secular values while maintaining an integral Islam? How do we do that? Is there a way? Or it's a too difficult a question?
It is not a difficult subject to answer. The example is staring in our face. That was Mustafa Kemal. He abolished the Khalifa.
Right.
And with the abolishment of the Khalifa, it was the abolishment of the Sharia. He threw the Sharia code out.
Right.
You know, and he abolished the Khalifa. And he said, now it will be the Republic of Turkey. The parliament will create the laws and define the laws. And so that will be the law. The lawmaking body of modern Turkey, that is the Kemalist Turkey, would be the parliament, and the law would be written by the parliament, that is the representative of the people.
Right.
So here is the interesting thing, God. I mean, if you think about it, you know, Sharia is not Islam. What has happened is Muslims have conflated Sharia with Islam. There was no Sharia as we understand it. You know, in the Islamic religion, there's the two great divisions, or one division that split Islam into two, that is the Muslim, not Islam, Muslims into two, which is Sunni and Shia.
Sure.
Sunni are the largest, 85% of the Muslim world is Sunni, and then the 15% is Shia with subsects in it, okay? Right. So, but this division was not a theological battle, it was a political battle.
Right. It was about descendants of Muhammad, yeah.
That's right, who is going to have the legitimacy of authority.
Right.
There was no Max Weber around at that time. Was somebody going to refer to Max Weber? Should it be charismatic and institutional and so on and so forth? Okay, so it was a political battle that took place. So when this battle took place, which was 50 years after the Prophet died, you know, whether it was the killing of Ali or the killing of Hussein, but the whole structure, this battle that erupted soon after the Prophet died, was about authority.
Right.
There was no Sharia. There was no Sunni or Shia. I mean, there is no reference to Sunni or Shia in the Quran.
Right.
There is no Sharia. You know, Sharia as a word, the word Sharia simply means the right path,
right,
or the good path. That's all. That is the moral injunction of God is to follow the good path.
Right.
You know, Sirat al-Mustaqim, as in Surah Fatiha it is said. So, there was no Sharia till about 250, 300 years later. I mean, the Sunnis have the Hanafi, the Maliki.
The four. There are four, right?
Four schools. So they were debating amongst each other how to read the Quran, how to read and understand the prophetic mission and all of that. And then they why it was? Because you have to run a government.
Right.
These camel riding, date eating people suddenly exploded. Defeated the Byzantine Empire.
You said camel riding. That's on you. Because now because that somebody will write now, some social justice warrior will write that it was a racist statement to use the term camel riding. But I'm just joking.
What else did they write?
No, I know.
Beautiful Arabian horses. True. I have that image, remember, from Lawrence of Arabia, the right movie, Anthony Quinn looking at that white horse.
Peter O'Toole, no?
Well, the Peter O'Toole is Lawrence, but you know,
that's right.
Quinn, remember that the train that is blown up?
Oh, right.
And there's a whole number of horses there, and he picks up the white horse, the beautiful Arab stallion, and, you know, rides away into the horizon.
So to bring back the conversation, so you're basically saying is that Sharia is really a very earthly reality.
Sharia is a human construction.
So it could be decoupled. Necessity. So it could be decoupled from the religion so that you could defect. Now, of course, there are many.
It's not only decoupled, God. It is not only. It's a human construction. It's not a word of God. Sharia is not a word of God. It's the word of Maliki and Hanafi and Shafi and all the schools arguing over what is right, what is wrong, and how to exist. And the Shia have their own.
Right.
Sharia, but and their own discourse.
Of course, though, there are many Islamic thinkers who will disagree with your position and that they'll say that.
But that's fine. I mean, you are asking me.
No, I know. But what I'm saying is, is there a way to get everybody on board at some point where there is broad consensus in a doctrinal sense? Because again, the fact that you can provide an argument that's very compelling as to how these things could be separate, I could bring as a guest another Islamic thinker who might say the exact opposite. So at some point, we have to reach a consensus whereby we could say, these are the elements. Here are the spiritual elements of Islam that we can all agree are perfectly consistent with secular liberal values. Here are the elements of political Islam that we don't want any part of. And so again, I come back, and we're close to ending our show. Do you think there will ever be broad consensus in terms of this clear delineation, where the spiritual elements of Islam that most Muslims practice, most are peaceful, most are kind, most don't want to cause trouble, where that element, right, or what, for example, Ayan Hirsi Ali would say, the Meccan Muslim versus the Medinan Muslim, right? So do you ever foresee a time where there will be broad doctrinal consensus about that split, where we get rid of the political element and keep the spiritual element?
Well, I mean, look, no, I don't conceive of that time.
Okay.
Because again, you know, Islam is, it's Islam in terms of meaning the people, the land, Darul Islam is vast. And it embraces lots of people, lots of ideas, lots of history, and so on and so forth. If you say, what is the kernel? What is the kernel? What's the acorn? What is the heart, you know? Then it is very simply, it is the Shahada.
Right.
La ilaha illallah.
Right.
You know, that's all there is to it, you know? Now, others will dispute it. Well, this is what John Locke was writing about, the letter of tolerance.
Right.
In the ayat in the Quran, it's a Meccan surah. One of the lines says, Lakum dinukum waliyadin. To you, your
right.
religion, to you, your. Or that can be interpreted, to you, your understanding, to you, your understanding. Right. You know, the idea of the Muslim, whichever Muslim is, that they understand the mind of God is, as I say in the metaphor, is like a gnat thinking that it understands the elephant.
Okay.
The finite trying to say that I understand the infinite.
Right.
You see, it is the philosophical development that has to take place. As I say, the Muslims are 14th century. This, by this I mean the civilization, the right. culture is only 14th century.
Yes.
So they are a teenager. But within it, there have been profoundly different people. I mean, I haven't mentioned, for instance, the Sufi tradition.
Of course.
The Sufi tradition didn't get involved in all of these things. You want to kill each other, go ahead and kill each other. For the Sufi tradition that evolved through the prophetic tradition and through the understanding of the Quran was about man's union with God.
Right.
The ayat in the Quran says that I am closer to you than your jugular vein.
Right.
That is, God is within us. And it is the question of how we come to terms with the divinity within us, in the sense that we have been created as images of God. That's in the Jewish tradition, that's in the Muslim tradition, or at least in the Sufi tradition. You see, the entire problematic is the theological construction of Islam, you know, and the debate over it. I put it very simply. God spoke to Muhammad. You believe in that. That is the Muslims who believe in that, that God spoke to Muhammad. Because this is a theological argument, that the Quran is the word of God. So, okay, if the Quran is the word of God, and you believe in this, you're a Muslim, I say, you believe in that the Quran is the word of God, the 114 chapter or 6,630 odd verses are the spoken words of God to Muhammad, to the prophet, and that when you read it, you're reading the word of God, then is the word of God frozen in time 14 centuries ago and has no meaning today? Because God, in the Quran itself, God is saying, or the ayat of the Quran saying, and its constant appeal to reason and rationality, that look around you, I am the author of the universe. God says, I am the author of the universe. So the universe is around you. He said, if you look at the universe and you want to say, find out, as God says in the Quran, God is saying, who created this? This didn't happen by itself. There is an author. I created this, you know. And you don't even have to listen to the book. You look at the world and you know that there is a la ilaha illallah. Okay. So, but if you are insisting on the book, that this is the word of God, I'm going to live by this book, then can't you understand that God is speaking to you right now?
Right.
And so, man has arrived in the moon.
So I guess what you're basically saying is that Islam, not unlike any of the other Abrahamic religions, does allow for interpretation to seep in so that it could be modernized. It is not this sort of inerrant
set. I'm going even further. I'm saying that, and I'm not the only one. I can run by you any number of Muslim thinkers and writers who have written about this, you know. So I'm not discovering a wheel. That Islam is in itself, if you follow the Sartrean or Hegelian language, right, in itself, not for itself, in itself is a modern by the thing is constantly generating a newer understanding of itself, is in itself at home in the world and in the universe.
And so is that, assume that we accept what you just said, is that the source that you use in looking forward in terms of the optimism that you can hope for? Because many people say, look, we're heading for an inevitable clash that's only going to be resolved in very ugly ways. Now, the message that you're offering at least provides people with some hope that, no, if taken with the proper lens of interpretation, there is no reason for Islam not to be coexistent with modernity. So is that, in your personal case, what you use to hopefully look forward to your children's time and say, look, I don't think we're going to relive the Lebanese Civil War. There is a way for us to avoid all this. There is hope. And the reason I'm asking this question this way is because it's always nice after such a heavy conversation to give people hope, to end it with a hopeful message. Hopefully a true message, but a hopeful one. So maybe we could sort of wrap it up with your best attempt at putting a hopeful message in terms of our trajectory.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. The only thing I would point out in a critical sense is the language that we have been using, you and I, and particularly you. You keep talking about Islam, and I want to talk about Muslim.
Okay,
because Islam is nothing without Muslim. It is the Muslim who gives meaning to Islam, you know, in the sense of how he lives his life. Islam means being at peace with the world. The word, I mean, you are an Arab, you know what the word Islam means. Salam, to be at peace. Shalom, I greet you, peace. Islam means to be at peace with the world.
Well, salim is to surrender, right? So yeah, we can well, debate that term, but okay.
Cognate words.
Yeah.
You know, it's the totality of it. Yeah, surrender, submission,
right,
in harmony. That which is in harmony is at peace with the world. A swimmer who doesn't know how to swim is thrashing in the water.
Right.
And a swimmer who is at home in water is totally lying at peace, is in harmony, in tranquility, in submission to the laws of how you operate in the water.
Right.
Okay, so it is the Muslim. And I think with 1.7 billion Muslims and growing in numbers, if there's a clash, and clash is happening, we're not speaking about it, the clash is happening right all around us. There's a warfare going on, violence going on. It is, what is this violence? It's going on with different characters of people.
Right.
You see, it has nothing to do with Islam. You know, there was Ali, Prophet's cousin, who was being killed by whom? By Muslim, not by Islam.
Right.
And his grandson, who was decapitated by whom? Not by Shia or Sunni or Islam, by Muslims.
Right.
So it is. By the way, this is back in a sense, you're wrapping this up, it goes completely back to the whole notion of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism, it is meant diversity, not equality, as this is in the public policy term. If it simply means diversity, we live in a world that is multicultural, plural, diverse, we cannot insist from that argument that the world is also equal, which is the public policy definition.
Right.
The very diversity means that, you know, people will have whole different understanding of the way that we conduct ourselves, the way we understand the world, the way we understand the universe. There will be complete dunderheads, with IQ that they cannot even tie their shoelaces, and there will be Einsteins in this world, there will be Beethovens in this world, Shakespeare's in this world.
I was going to say, let us hope that the majority of the ones that are bringing their individual interpretations.
No, I don't think so. I think that is the utopianism. I mean, I am optimistic.
Right.
You know, I embrace you, or you embrace me, Saad, as I go. I was in Jerusalem a few years ago, and, you know, I went to the wall and I prayed there. You know, I don't expect that on some other Muslim will do that. You know, there will be Muslims, you know, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's followers, they will come and decapitate me, right, if they can, you know. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, they decapitated Hussein.
Right.
They crucified Jesus, you know, from the Christian point of view. You know, they forced Socrates to drink a hemlock. I mean, this is the reality of the world.
You're talking about human. You're talking about human frailties, basically.
Yeah, but the ultimate peace is the peace in the heart of individual. That's where I mean, back to classical liberalism. It is the emphasis on individual freedom.
Right.
You see, it is to nurture the capacity of the individual to be the fullest of what that individual he or she can rise to, can assimilate.
That's a perfect place to end it. Is there anything that you'd like me to, before we end, promote? Is there a project that you're working on or an organization that you're working with that you think that
I'm not into promotion. I am just the delight of speaking.
You too. It was unbelievable. Of course, we could probably go on for another 5 hours at the very least, but then it would take me 5 days to upload the damn thing on YouTube. So if only for that reason, this is probably a good place to end. Stay on the line. A true pleasure and honor to chat with you. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to stop it, but stay on the line. Thank you so much, Salim.
Thank you. Shalom.